Blog Talk Radio.
Evening, Commissioner. Why so serious?
Colonel, I've been a soldier now for 2 years. As a scout, horseman, marksman, scavenger.
That's so.
Yes, sir. I could be of better service with the regulars.
Where'd you learn all that riding, shooting, scavenging?
My father taught me.
I told you it. It ain't gonna be that way. You know, you got your wife and baby in Texas, and you know, I got my life in Riverton.
That's so. You and Alma, that's a lie.
Oh, you shut up about Alma. This ain't her fault. And the bottom line is, we're around each other, and this thing grabs hold of us again in the wrong place, in the wrong time, and we're dead.
Those are clips from some of Heath Ledger's films. The last one you heard was from his Oscar-nominated performance in Brokeback Mountain, and previous to that was his star-making turn opposite Mel Gibson in The Patriot. And at the very top of the show, you heard a clip or two from his upcoming performance as the Joker. Of course, we all know that Heath Ledger passed away this past week, and we're going to spend some time celebrating the work that he left us. You know, there's a lot of speculation about how this happened, but none of that diminishes from what he contributed to the art of acting. And that's what we're going to focus on during this segment here. This is Movie Geeks United, and my name is Jamie. I'm one of your co-hosts. Our other two co-hosts are here with us tonight, too. Introduce yourself, guys.
It's Jerry. Hey, everybody. It's Chris here.
It's good to have everybody here tonight.
It is. And the original, the way it was meant to be, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Which one? Which is which?
I think we all, like, because they're schizophrenic, we probably all encompass all of those virtues.
Yeah. We appreciate everyone being in the chat room tonight. You can log on to our chat room if you're listening now and converse with other fans of films, other fans of Heath Ledger. We're also going to be covering the Oscars for a good length of time during the show. But we encourage everyone to call in to share your thoughts, because we're just going to share our thoughts between the three of us in this first segment. And when that's done, if we've received no phone calls, we'll move on to the Oscars. But we encourage anyone that has anything to say about Heath Ledger's work, please give us a call, 718-508-9477. All right, guys, so let's review his work. I mean, we've all been inundated with the news coverage, and you know, obviously all of us are shocked, like the whole world is shocked by the news of his passing. But let's focus on his performances that he's left us. Starting with the first time he really entered the consciousness of American audiences was probably 10 Things I Hate About You. But did you see anything he did prior in his work in Australia?
Sadly, no. I still haven't seen the movie Two Hands, which I've been meaning to see ever since a guy at the video store that we used to have up the street from us told me about it, which has got about 10 years ago. But that would be the film I think we're all thinking of. But no, I haven't,
yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, he did some television work in Australia. He was born in Australia, obviously, and he came to the States, and he hit apart like pretty soon after coming to LA and 10 Things I Hate About You, which is a, you know, a teenage kind of film, but it was taken from Shakespeare, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Taming of the Shrew.
Yeah, that's right.
Interpretation
of Taming of the Shrew.
And I'm fully to blame for this. I am a lot of times unfairly critical of the teen genre film.
How dare you?
I know, how dare I? But what were your thoughts? You know, a lot of people in tributes that are happening here and there, they mention 10 Things I Hate About You as you know, like a great performance of his that they remember fondly.
It absolutely was. Yeah.
It was. Yeah. You
at the time, sorry. Go ahead, Jack.
No. Please. I've said so much on this. Please, Chris. I want to hear you. So.
Well, I was just going to say that at the time, of course, you know, we were inundated with teen movies, the teen comedies, and the sort of gross out comedies, and that came out right around the same time. But it was a little bit of a different movie. But it was striking how much he stood out in it, especially he has he does a musical number at one point in the movie, and it became really obvious that this guy was super talented, and he really stood out in that movie. It's actually not a bad movie, and in no small part because he's so good in it.
Yeah, and he had right out of the gate the movie star charisma. And he had that kind of charisma that you could bank on for an entire career. I mean, we've known people that have done that, doing these types of movies. And you know, he used this film to break into the business, but he didn't stay there. I mean, he made it pretty clear that he didn't want to be stuck making these kinds of, you know, these teen movies that kind of pigeonhole you in a way.
Mm-hmm, right.
And he really set out to break through that. And I think that The Patriot, which was an opportunity to came up shortly afterwards, the film came out a year after 10 Things I Hate About You, I think that really opened up the gates for him. And I think it was a relationship that he started with Mel Gibson, and I think Mel Gibson fought for him to be able to do that film,
mm-hmm.
Patriot.
That's right.
That's really the first time I came to notice Heath Ledger in a movie that I really had no problem with. I thought it was quite an entertaining movie, and I thought that they worked well off one another.
Well, I think that's the core of that film too, is the father-son relationship. You take that out of it, and I think the film loses a lot. But you had no problem believing that they were father and son. They complemented each other very well.
Yeah, and it was very, very kind of. It was a very kind of dramatic. And it was the family dynamic that made it so dynamic and affecting,
mm-hmm.
in that movie. And he was toe-to-toe with Mel Gibson, and he had as much... Talk about movie star charisma. Mel Gibson has it in spades. And,
right.
And, Heath Ledger was toe-to-toe with him all the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went off and did A Knight's Tale, which I know so many people are fond of.
Oh, yeah.
Just because it's a fun movie, and it's a kind of... outside of the box, you know, outside of the norm kind of movie for that genre. What are you guys' thoughts on that film?
Chris?
Well, I got to be honest, I was never a huge fan of Knight's Tale. My girlfriend is in love with the movie, and in fact just watched it again. You could see that he held his own in it, and it was kind of the line in between teen star and you know, leading actor. He kind of walked that line in that movie. That was kind of a transitional movie, I think, because it was a little bit different, and it wasn't exactly a teen comedy, although it appealed to teens. He really proved again that he could hold a movie on his own in that movie, and I think he did.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the next movie he did was Monsters Ball, and I remember actually watching Monsters Ball and being really affected by his performance. Obviously, it's a tragic performance that meets its end like halfway through the film, and it's the catalyst for the change that has to occur,
right,
to the leading characters in that film. But something struck me as that I kind of knew that that's the kind of movie that he wanted to do.
Yes,
he wanted to explore those kinds of depths with the characters he played, and he shined in that movie.
Mm-hmm. He did. When he leaves the movie, you could honestly say the movie, you know, the movie loses a lot of interest for me. It loses a lot of steam when he leaves.
Yeah, yeah, but I think it's the movie's most powerful moment.
It is. And he's very good in that.
And all this time he's working with great people. You know, he has a leading role, you know, after The Patriot in a movie that he carries on his own with A Knight's Tale. And then he goes and he does a supporting role with great actors, great material,
mm-hmm.
with Munster's Ball. I mean, that's an important stepping stone for him.
It is.
And a great movie. I mean, that's a downer of a movie. But, but it is damn effective. And he's working with Billy Bob Thornton and great, great people
mm-hmm.
that he has to learn a lot from. And so now he's basically, he's in leading man territory, and he has his choice of films to do, and he takes some interesting turns. There's The Four Feathers, which is the kind of the epic film with Kate Hudson, right?
Yeah, with Kate Hudson. It's I think the third or fourth remake of that.
Yeah.
But he was very good in that. I mean, I don't think it's a great film, but he was good in that.
Well, and he has a series of films that the quality of them are up to dispute, but you can understand why he chose them.
Oh yeah.
There's Ned Kelly that he did afterward. I think that's reunite he with no that was Gregor Jordan that directed Ned Kelly. The Order was the thing that reunited him with Brian Helgeland.
Yeah, that was a troubled production too. That they had been working on that for a long time.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That was the only thing I have to honestly say. That would be the only film of his that I wasn't crazy about, The Order.
Yeah. So I have not seen The Order. What is The Order about?
Oh, dude, I don't.
He plays
I don't remember.
Priest.
It's been like four years, I think, since I've seen it.
But he plays a priest.
He plays a priest. It's a supernatural film. But it was a big deal because they were aching to work together again. And I think it was originally, I think in Europe it's called The Sin Eater, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
The original title.
Yeah.
That changed right before it was released to the
yeah.
for some reason.
And I just sadly could not get into it. But, you know, he has screen presence. You'll watch him. I think you would have watched him in anything. You know, he has that charisma as you're talking about. It's there. It was there from 10 Things I Hate About You and, you know, all the way through.
We have someone in the chat room that mentioned the film Roar.
Oh, that's a TV show, the Australian TV show.
Yeah. And that's one of the films he did in Australia prior to coming to L.A. and doing 10 Things I Hate About You. But that was a film he did in Australia, like the last thing he did before he hit it in America. It was nominated for a Primetime Emmy Award, I see here, Roar was. And he was surrounded by a good cast, like Melissa George and Vera Farmiga was in that one.
Yeah, that's right.
If anybody wants to call in and share your thoughts on any of these performances or any of these favorite films, you're more than welcome to do so. The number is 518, no, it's not, hang on, number 718-508-9477. Lords of Dogtown, what do we think of that one?
I like that. You know, it's the narrative version of the Stacey Peralta documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
But I enjoyed that film. I know a lot of people didn't, but and I liked him in it a lot. He had this kind of going, this Val Kilmer-esque performance going through it, like from The Doors and from Wonderland, and he was just phenomenal in it.
It's got, excuse me, it's got a cult following, that movie does. I mean, there's some people that absolutely swear by that movie. It's one of those quotable movies too, isn't it? Where a lot of people quote from it here and there.
I'm not sure because I don't hang with the young kids. You know, I know you all think that I do, but
right.
I don't hang with them. But I'm sure. But you actually, to be very honest with you, that's very true. They do.
See, yeah, I hang out at the skate park.
I knew you did. I never doubted that about you.
I don't know. I've never heard anyone quote the movie, but I have heard people sort of do his voice in the movie because it was the first time he really made this like very unique character. The first time I ever saw him step out, like you're saying, like the way Val Kilmer will step into something and sort of transform into this other person
and
right.
would do that too. And so he has this very like kind of surfer slacker way of talking in the movie. And of course he had these false teeth that he wore too to get into the character's Skip, I think his name was. And
yeah, that's right.
I think it's a fantastic movie actually. And his performance again really stuck out. He was not the teen. He kind of stepped into the adult role into the movie. He sort of was the leader of these teens and kind of organized
right.
them into the skating crew. And yeah, he has this very, very unique way of talking. I've heard people do that. You're right.
You know what though, and this characterizes a couple of his performances. He was very concerned with the voice. What impressed me most about Heath Ledger is that he knew where his career could have gone, and he starved himself without work until he got parts that he wanted, that he knew would further his career and put him in a place where he wanted to be, which was considered a serious actor, which he got to that place, and he was considered a serious actor, probably the most promising actor of his generation. But he was also very inventive as an actor, endlessly so. And we're gonna discuss that. You touched on that with Lords of Dogtown. We're gonna discuss it more with Brokeback and what we assume he's done with the Joker in The Dark Knight. He went on to do The Brothers Grimm, which is not a remarkable film, but it's understandable to want to work in that company.
I would want to work in that company. I don't care who you are. If you had the chance to work with Terry Gilliam, you know, everyone wants that opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously he enjoyed it because then later on he went to work for him again. And you're right, it's not a great movie. Even in terms of Terry Gilliam movies, it's lower on my list. But it's not a horrible movie either. I
mean, not at all. No, it does have those moments of genius, those Gilliam moments in it.
And he did, he and Damon actually had a pretty good sort of screen rapport together and actually made somewhat interesting team. It's a shame that the project didn't quite, you know, reach that level. But the two of them actually worked really well together, and it was nice to see him working alongside another, you know, probably, in my opinion, the next, another second best actor of his generation.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Matt Damon's got it, definitely. But, then again, it goes to show he's working. He knows the company he keeps is the key to continued growth as an actor. He's working with exceptional people. And you're right about the Gilliam thing, and obviously, he was working not very long on this new Terry Gilliam movie, which Terry Gilliam Productions. I mean, are they ever going to be easy?
No, it doesn't seem like they are.
You know, and the rumor now is that apparently he shot enough of this film, but there's so much left. But there's kind of like a rabbit hole sequence I've read where he can easily become a different person. At a certain point,
yeah, you were telling me about that last night.
And the rumor mill is that they're going to cast someone else to continue Heath Ledger's role. So that this might not be the Joker might not be the last opportunity we have to see Heath Ledger on screen. Of course, it being a Gilliam film, the first name they're mentioning is Johnny Depp, who I can't imagine wouldn't do it. But we'll just have to wait and see. It's all rumor and speculation at this point. But his next movie, following The Brothers Grimm, was really like, you know, obviously he was heterosexual, but it was his coming out as a great actor, you know, pardon the expression, but that's what it was. It was his Oscar-nominated performance in Brokeback Mountain. So let's discuss this a little bit. Your thoughts on the film and his performance.
Well, the film, I love the film, personally. I think it's really beautiful and haunting, kind of traditional love story, really, about these two souls that are, you know, in love with each other, but for one reason or another are not able to spend their lives together. And I remember, you know, of course the movie had all that buzz around it when it came out, and specifically about Heath Ledger, and I remember thinking, when I read Peter Travers' review of it, and he called it an acting miracle. And I remember reading that before I saw the movie and thinking, wow, that's
right.
That's pretty incredible.
What praise.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's pretty amazing praise to give to somebody. I wonder if it can really lead up to it and stand up to that sort of praise. And, of course, in my opinion, it did. It really is an acting miracle. I thought it was an amazing performance. Just completely inhabited this character and transcended Heath Ledger in every way. He was absolutely not himself. Really incredible and touching performance.
And the clearest indication of the promise that he had as an actor. The clearest indication we've had yet. And look at the material. Look at the bravery of choosing the material. Obviously, it has a great message, but it took a fair amount of bravery, I would think, to accept that role. And I'm sure that many people's fingerprints had been on that script, and they turned it down for that reason, probably,
right.
Fear. And he was working with a world-class director, and he did something very inventive with the role. And Chris, you and I talked about this last night, and Jerry, we talked about this before the show, and it has to do with voice again. His kind of like muffled, kind of talking through tight lips, you know, that was the physicalization of what that character represented. You know, that shell, you know, not wanting to come out, not wanting to share or open up, you know. Incredibly inventive. And I saw that people, when you do something like that, people will respond right away and say, yeah, I get it. And other people will say, oh, I didn't like, what was the deal with the voice and the mouth and everything, you know. But it makes complete sense with that character. It is dramatizing that character's journey just by simple decisions he makes with his voice. And it is an incredible movie. It's a movie I kind of admire more than I enjoy watching. I didn't think it ultimately took the right direction. There was a sense of urgency that I thought was missing from the direction that was there in the performances towards the end, but I didn't think it was there in the direction of it. But even so, I walked out and I kind of saw the film as a missed opportunity, but at the same time, I knew that Heath Ledger owned the film. I knew without a doubt that this was his shining moment so far in his career. Jerry, you have any thoughts on Brokeback?
It is the most romantic film to come out of the Hollywood in quite some time. I would actually say even one of my favorite romantic epics, Dr. Zhivago, it's right up there with that, if not better. His performance, not only is brave, but the scene with the jacket is... You just can't help but cry during that scene. That's a heartbreaking, heart-wrenching scene. He is superb in that movie. Everyone is actually... You know, there are a couple performances in that movie that are revelations within themselves, but for him to, you know, like you said, it is a very brave performance. It's sad we have to say that, but in the environment and the climate, especially when that was released, you do have to say it's a brave performance. It's for, I think that's the role that he will always, when we mention his name, Ennis is what he's going to be, always associated with that.
Well, I think that's going to be true until the Joker. But we're about to get to the Joker.
Yeah, we got to get to the Joker.
Say one other thing about his performance in Brokeback Mountain. Really, I could talk about his performance in Brokeback all night long, but one of the incredible things about it for me is this absolutely astonishing range of emotions that he displays in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere from, you know, from the sorrow that you were touching on, Jerry, at the end of the movie, of course, and throughout the movie, and, you know, the sort of just bliss that he feels when he is with Jack Twist, who, of course, is, you know, the love of his life, and that's,
right.
You know, those small time that they get to spend with each other every year or every couple months, and then the anger that he's able to express in some of those really striking scenes in the movie, like at the firework display, for instance, or the scene where he confronts the guy in the truck when he's crossing the street. All these emotions that he is able to display in this movie, and none of them seem out of place for this character. It feels like that is Ennis's rage and his bliss and his sorrow.
But at the same time, when he finally Let's Go at the end with the jacket scene that that Jerry's talking about. Mm-hmm. But what makes it so powerful is that he is a character that is built upon storing these emotions, not showing these emotions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say, what's more powerful than watching an actor cry? And that's watching an actor try not to cry. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the drama of it, you know. That's what pulls you in. And I think that's indicative of that entire performance.
Yeah,
and it had to have been tough. No, what a challenge for an actor.
Yeah, there's this ambiguity in the end of the movie as to whether or not Jack was indeed killed by you know, the tire blowing out, or if he was killed
a victim of a hate crime.
A victim of a hate crime. But of course, I don't think that's the truth. Of course, I think he was killed by the tire. I think it was an accident. But the thing is that's so ingrained in Ennis's character, that fear of that sort of violence against him and against, you know, his kind, that he convinces you as an audience member that he really believes that. And maybe it could be, you know, he's so afraid that you believe it.
Right.
There wasn't a better acted scene all that year than, and it's my favorite scene in the movie, than when Michelle Williams is washing dishes.
Oh yeah,
and they have that confrontation.
Yeah,
and I mean Michelle Williams is a revelation in that movie too.
Yes, she is.
Yeah, I mean big time. So he was in a really good place career-wise with Brokeback. Obviously, he went and did Casanova. Anyone see Casanova?
Yeah,
version of that. Tell me about that. I have not yet seen that.
No, you haven't. It's all right. It's very fluff. I think, what is that? Leslie Hallstrom. Directed that.
Yeah.
It's a fluff piece. It has Lena Olin.
It seemed like a real kind of odd choice to go from Brokeback to Casanova.
The irony is not lost on me while watching that. But it's an enjoyable, but it's a very fluff piece.
Yeah.
It's not something like you really remember, but you don't mind watching it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not.
And there's nothing fluff about Candy, which is the movie he followed it.
That's bleak. Oh, that's a bleak one.
That's a devastating kind of movie.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, Jerry.
Well, it's like you could honestly say it's you know, it's definitely on par with Panic in Needle Park, or Drugstore Cowboy. It's very depressing. Movies about drug addicts are very, you know, they're not uplifting. And you're,
but at its core,
it's the perfect vehicle for an actor. I think like something like Matt Dillon did in Drugstore Cowboy or Pacino very early on in Panic to this range of, you know, the downward spiral.
Yeah.
And
at the same time, it's a love story, too. I mean,
oh, yes. Well, and then the films I mentioned, the other films are also love stories, if you think about it as well. And it pays homage to those films. But it's not an easy film to watch. As I get older, the films about drug addicts and those sort of things, they're not easy to watch.
Yeah. Something that you have seen, Jerry, that we have not been able to because we live in Podunk, Florida. It's I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan story where he plays one of the incarnations of Dylan.
Okay, I need to get on my soapbox here.
Okay, go ahead.
Everyone is very good playing Bob Dylan. Each performance in this film, I know everyone is like... And I love Kate Blanchett, don't get me wrong. She's great in the film. But everyone playing Bob Dylan is very good. And while you're watching this, when Heath Ledger comes on, you are just like, oh my God. You didn't think... You know, 'cause we're all like... It's like this thing that, oh, Kate Blanchett walks away with the movie. That's not the case. Everyone does.
Right.
But he's just a powerhouse, I would have to say. It's like Clive Owen in Closer. He's just incredible.
Yeah.
I was astounded because no one's making a big deal about this in the reviews. And, you know, Christian Bale's awesome, but Heath Ledger is just great in the part. I mean, he's like, he'll always be in my mind to be associated with Bob Dylan now.
Right. I saw him interviewed, and I was thinking about this tonight because the SAG Awards come on tonight. And the one thing that I like about the SAG Awards is the cast the Best Cast
award.
Shouldn't I'm Not There be nominated? I mean, if any movie or a cast had to join together to express, you know, a singular theme.
It should be nominated. Not only nominated, it just should be given the award this year.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about that earlier today when I was looking over the SAG nominations. But I saw him in a press conference, and he was talking about that, and someone asked him which one's more challenging, Bob Dylan or the Joker. And he said the Joker's the most challenging thing he's ever done. With Bob Dylan, he didn't feel restrained or imprisoned to have to do an impersonation of Bob Dylan. You know, it was, and I think that that's probably true of everyone that played him in
no
that film.
Yeah, no one's doing an impersonation in the movie. That's why I think it really works when all is said and done, is no one's doing an impersonation.
Yeah.
So, but he, you know, but everyone is very good in the film, but he's very good. And it's a shame. I think, was it the Spirit Awards? It's won the Robert Altman Award for ensemble performances.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well,
and it deserves it. I mean, hands down, it deserves that.
And now we're looking at The Dark Knight, which is coming out, obviously, this summer. Not that anyone on the planet doesn't know about this film.
Right.
It's going to be huge, and it's going to be the cap on his legacy, unfortunately. But from what I've heard about it and his approach to it, I mean, this is a very dynamic performance and an incredibly inventive performance. I think I read that it took him just a short time to agree to do it, like 15 minutes, and he read the script and he talked to Chris Nolan, and he came with a ton of ideas to Chris Nolan, and they were on the same page just to make it a merciless, psychotic, no boundaries kind of, you know, incredibly loose performance. And you talk about his work with voice. I read a recent interview with Chris Nolan, and he said, you know, honestly, he said Harvey Dent is the soul of this movie, and we haven't seen any of his character yet.
Wow.
But he did say, but everybody's going to be talking about Heath Ledger because he is a force in this movie. You haven't seen this performance before. It is so outside of the box. It is so inventive, wildly so, and it's petrifying what he does with this character, he said. And he talked about the voice. He talked about his use of voice changes from like one scene to another. It just becomes like more and more kind of menacing, whether it's high pitched or low pitched or different things. And you can tell by the teaser trailer that we're seeing for this too, his work with voice in this film. And months ago, I heard an interview with Michael Caine, and they asked him about Batman. And he said, you know, what everyone's, Heath Ledger is this Batman movie. I mean, then no one's going to be able to talk about anything else. What do you think, what sense do you get of his performance in this film? And do you think that this unfortunate event is going to affect the way it's viewed somehow?
I don't know that it's, I mean, I obviously, the, you know, what's happened with his death and all, it's going to affect. You're not going to be able to watch the movie without that coming into your mind at one point or another. I don't think it's going to affect the movie in terms of its acceptance or, you know, I don't think it's going to be any bigger or smaller audience because of Heath Ledger's death. But one of the interesting things, I think, about him playing the Joker is the fact that, you know, of course, the first movie ended with a tease that the Joker was going to be the villain in the second movie. And
right.
It was a very successful movie. So it was, you know, very coveted role. And, of course, the last time we saw the Joker, who played him? It was Jack Nicholson, you know.
Right.
One of the biggest movie stars in the world. So who are you going to get to step into those shoes? And everybody wanted this part, remember. I mean, they were like...
Sean Penn.
A lot of people. Yeah, Sean Penn, Crispin Glover. There was talk of Michael Keaton playing it. And some of these were internet rumors, but even looking at them as internet rumors, that just tells you what audiences think about this character. We need someone who can hold this role down. And when Heath Ledger was cast, it was sort of a surprise. It was a little shocking at first, but then everybody, myself included, sort of said, okay, yeah, I can, you know, and the reason that is, I think, is because, obviously, of his performance in Brokeback Mountain. He displayed that he's capable of going from someplace like 10 Things I Hate About You, where he's very good, to something like his performance as Ennis in Brokeback Mountain. He's the kind of actor who's capable of that sort of range. So it's perfectly believable that he could step into this, you know, this wildly homicidal role and this iconic character. I think that's
really that's a challenge enough. Just to discard everything in your mind about the Nicholson performance and not kind of emulate any characteristics of it, to make it completely your own. When the Nicholson performance, I mean, it's pop culture now. I mean, it's we think Joker, we think Nicholson, but I think that'll all change this summer.
Yeah,
you know, with Nolan's movie comes out.
And plus, let me get on my comic book nerd soapbox here for a second.
Go ahead.
Please, you know, I'm a comic book nerd. I can't help it. But and I never read a lot of DC comics, but I did read Batman, and especially some of the graphic novels, like Arkham Asylum, for instance, or The Killing Joke, are really
right.
Great. And I would recommend those to anyone who's interested in comic books or in Heath Ledger, just, you know, in terms of anticipating his performance. The Jack Nicholson Joker was fine for the Tim Burton movie, but that's not really who the Joker was. The Joker really was a terrifying character. He's not the
right.
Jack Nicholson character. He's not the Cesar Romero character either. He really was a psychotic, terrifying individual. And that's why I think, just in terms of what I've seen so far in the preview and what I've heard from Chris Nolan and Michael Caine, I'm so excited because it seems like we're really going to finally get this character the way he was supposed to be played.
Right. Even Frank Miller's interpretation of him, it seems like from that trailer.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So it's very, you know, I've got, like everyone, mixed emotions about this movie because I was already, you know, it was already number one on my list. I'd told you that several times, Jamie. But now, of course, it is going to affect the way we look at it. But I think, I predict that he's such a fine actor that you're going to be able to watch the movie and enjoy the movie regardless. I think even in death, he'll be able to be able to overcome that.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree 100%, Chris.
Yeah. We're going to open up the show now. To discussion of the Oscars, we've run a little bit over, but if anyone wants to call any time during the show, the number to call is 718-508-9477. Okay, we've discussed the films of Heath Ledger, and now let's discuss this year's Oscar nominees.
Okay.
You guys ready to kind of shift gears here?
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm opening up at the Oscar.com page.
Okay, you're all set, ready
I'm all
go.
Set. I'm all ready.
Okay. We have a very special guest joining our roundtable tonight to discuss the Oscar nominations, and that is our good friend Keith Ulick, a very, very fine film writer. You can find his work online, and I'll let Keith tell you everywhere you can find his work. He's one of the best. Keith, are you with us?
Yeah. Hey, guys. How are you?
Hey, it's good to have you back.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Keith. First of all, before we get started, tell our listeners everywhere that they can find you, because you have a podcast show and you have all these places where you post reviews. Where can they find your stuff?
Well, primarily The House Next Door, which is mattzollersites.blogspot.com. Matt Seitz is a critic for The Times, formerly New York Press, and that's his personal blog that's quickly become a big site that I co-edit with a lot of writers and contributors. And
your stuff is great there.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And also I write for UGO Underground Online, which is www.ugo.com. And if everything goes well, I'll soon be having a weekly podcast of my On the Circuit series starting in February, which comes out of Zoom In Online. So I think that's enough self-promotion.
Okay.
You've got a lot of fingers and a lot of pies there, man.
Yeah.
Doing my
You're going to be a brand unto yourself. First of all, what do we think of the Oscars to begin with? Do we think that they're relevant? Keith, you can take that one first. What's the relevancy of the Oscars?
I think they're a good excuse to have a party. That's about it.
Are you going to buy my drinks for me?
Hey, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I buy plenty of wine for everybody when they come over to my place.
I'm coming over.
Although, of course, this year we might not have a show, you know, which is probably another topic to get into a little later.
Yes.
We should.
Yeah, but, I mean, aside from that, no, I don't really take them all that seriously, and quite frankly, I was glad there was no Golden Globes show, per se, this year. I just sat downstairs and read, and my boyfriend Dan came down afterwards and just, you know, told me, oh, my God, that was the worst thing ever, and I was like, yep.
Okay. Billy right. Bush will do that to you.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
he scared me.
Any Bush will do that to you.
Yeah,
pardon
I mean,
pardon me for being politically obvious, but
no, that's all right. I mean, we were getting on this case. I was like, you know, that comment that sent me over the edge. He said about Cate Blanchett when she won Best Supporting Actress, and he made a comment, I don't see what was so tough about that role. It's just a girl playing a man.
Meanwhile, this guy's hair glows in the dark. You can see it for like 5,000 miles, Johnny.
The radioactive bushes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, me personally, I don't think the Oscars are all that great. But, you know, I mean.
Wouldn't that be refreshing, though, if actually one of the entertainers, like one of the actors that opened up the envelope, read the name to themselves and like, this is bullshit.
Yeah, I'm going to give it to someone else.
That'd be the greatest YouTube moment ever.
Yeah. What would they do? I mean, I think that was like speculated at one time because I think somebody like Elizabeth Taylor was kind of out of it one year when she announced Best Picture, and they questioned whether or not she read the right winner.
Right, same with, I remember Jack Palance
that's right.
reading Marissa Tomei's name and whether that was right or not.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. These kind of urban legends.
Yeah, and, well, you know, you get that or you get Vanessa Redgrave calling you Zionist hoodlums, you know, I mean.
Oh, God.
Or you get a streaker running across the stage, so, I mean, yeah.
But isn't that kind of secretly what we want in a live ceremony? I mean, isn't live?
And, of course, here I am saying I don't really give a shit about them, and yet I know all this Oscar trivia. So it's not like I don't watch them, and it's not like if I were, you know, ever nominated for one God knows what for, I wouldn't go and have a time of it, you know.
Right.
I mean, of course I would, but
yeah.
It's like,
yeah. We want Michael Moore to win for Sicko because we'll know. I mean, I'm rooting for No End in Sight because I like both of those films, but we do want Michael Moore, I think, to win just because we know we're going to get a response like no other.
Yeah, probably.
He's in disbelief that he's nominated again. He said after that speech I gave last time, I had every indication that I'd never appear on the Oscars again.
Oh, no, they want that, and it's good for ratings. I mean, they'll take what they can get. I mean,
yeah, they should. They've had a pretty shoddy reputation in terms of overlooking good documentary work in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no argument with Sicko. You know,
No End in Sight won. I wouldn't, and there are others that are on there I know that are good. I haven't been released yet. I wouldn't have a problem with any of those.
I think they dropped the ball on a few documentaries that I saw this year.
I know one that you're thinking of. So
yeah. It's no secret about my feelings about the Camden 28. But
they're not smart like you are.
That's right.
They just don't have that. They don't have the DeVal gene. They just don't have it.
Well, how about a Movie Geeks United award show?
That's a great idea.
That
man.
Is an awesome idea, Keith. But I would be sued, and I don't have the legal representation.
Oh.
I would be sued
because of your choices, or
no, because of my mouth.
Your mouth. Well.
Well, this would be obviously be an uncensored ceremony. It would, you know, it'd be an R-rated, be kind of akin to the AVN Awards, I think.
I think you're right.
Well, we get to the end of tonight. I might be the one being sued, but we'll see.
Oh shit! Okay.
But Chris, do you find the Oscars relevant, Chris?
Well, you know, it's kind of, I feel kind of the same way he does. I enjoy them. I watch them every year, and you know, of course, I come to your house and we have a little party, or I've had parties at my house before. But relevant? No, they've made as many great decisions as they have horrible and shitty decisions in the past.
Yeah.
You know, there's plenty of them that leap to mind. So,
is there any relevancy to the idea that this is the biggest night for the industry? Personally, I only kind of take stock in the Oscars in a way because I think this is a season that is so self-congratulatory. I mean, how much can you pat each other on the back with all these countless award shows? But
there are a lot
of them.
Tonight we have the SAGs.
Yeah, and I kind of like the SAGs too. I do like the idea of the SAGs. But you know, it's the biggest night in the industry, and these films are given a global spotlight. That has to be count for something, right?
Well, let me let me chime in here. Just, I do like the Oscars. I know a lot of people think I hate the Oscars. No, I like them, and I watch them every year, much to everyone's dismay in my house. Although when The Wire comes on, I won't lie to you, we watch The Wire, and then we go back to the Oscars. But I think in the age of the Internet, Jamie, I'm not sure about that, because everyone who's interested in the films that are nominated knows about them. I don't know if the Oscars in the age of the Internet bring that the awareness that it once did.
Hmm. See, I know that you're probably similar to me, Jerry, in that when I was a kid, I watched the Oscars, and
Carson hosted, you couldn't get me away. My dad was like, we're watching the tennis matches. I don't care about the Oscars. No, but it's Carson.
But I would kind of dream, and it would be like a fantasy night for me when I was a kid watching it.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
it kind of maintains that for me somewhat, even though I can see through a lot of the bullshit now. But in terms of the actual show, as an adult watching it, I can see why are these productions still so awful? Why do we still have 15 musical numbers, and why do we still have all these assemblages of clips, like six of them during the ceremony that don't mean anything? I mean,
that don't mean anything.
Actual
ceremony.
We must have them.
No,
otherwise it wouldn't be the Oscars.
I understand what Jamie's saying, especially about the clips. If you wanted to show the clips, the only clip thing you need to show is the 100 years of movies or Precious Images every year. That's the only thing I would show.
Yeah.
Because that's by far, we both agree, I think that's the best montage. Those two are the best montages ever made. The others that they make, like some of the ones they had last year, the year before, you're watching them, you're just like, okay, you mean to tell me there was someone with a commercial who couldn't come on right now?
And so less of the ballet troupes doing shadow puppets of the Best Picture nominees?
That was scary.
I kind of like that, though.
Scary, Jamie. I wanted another bottle of tequila after that. I mean,
they make the Little Miss Sunshine van. It's like, what?
it is some of these moments, too, these embarrassing moments that we grunt over every year that makes it kind of... makes it kind of fun in a way too. I mean, every time that corpse Arthur Hiller like walks on stage and his bad like,
we don't get Arthur Hiller on the show now.
Director of Carpool, Arthur Hiller.
That's right, Arthur. It is kind of like we all groan, but it is still, you know, like the yearly ritual that, you know, that's the Oscars.
Well, let me ask you. Let me pose something here, because you were talking about watching it as a kid and everything. So, do any of you all know some younger cinephiles, like children's age, who are watching it now, and what their reaction to it has been?
You're right. No, I don't.
No, I have no idea.
Because I'd be curious to know what that is. I mean, you know, because I'm constantly surrounded by, you know, people my age or older who are, you know, kind of, I guess, cynical and stuff and this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, I have met a lot of, I'd say, like, college-age people. I'm not necessarily just talking about the Oscars here, but who do have a more, a less cynical outlook on things. And kind of do find some kind of glamour in it, you know, and or interest and excitement, I suppose. And I mean, I do too. I mean, I don't want to paint myself only as a cynic, but I'm just curious about, you know, what the younger generations now might be thinking of the show, and that would be interesting.
I'm sure as long as there are people that dream, I mean, there'll be people that look to the Oscars in that way, you know. I am not one to speak to the pulse of the youth. I mean, I still listen to Barry Manilow music. I have no idea what anybody else likes or dislikes younger than I.
I think when the Oscars are on, that's the last weekend in February, they'll be watching pirated copies of Cloverfield and Jumper probably. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's what our youth is doing.
Or hopefully maybe having Kurosawa film festivals like I did, but you know, I mean, there's got to be someone out there like that.
Right.
Oh, that would be so encouraging. Do we think that the Oscars are an important enough event that they can't not happen? I mean, do you think in your gut that they're going to happen no matter what this year?
They're going to happen in some way.
Yeah, it will happen in some way, but I do actually think because of the dismal reaction to the Golden Globes, that's why this, you know, I don't care who you are, if you watch that, you're like, oh my God. We can't have that. I think, and if I, before we get off this, I think people are shocked in the general population that people write for these award shows.
Mm.
I do think there that people are, you mean someone wrote that?
Rich Valanche, baby.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, yeah. Anytime anyone asks, did somebody actually write that?
Yeah,
the answer is always Bruce Valanche.
No, but I mean, that's people are shocked. I think that people, we know that people write that, but I think, you know, outside of, like, you know, movie or the industry or people who are associated with films or no, they are shocked at that. You mean someone wrote this?
Award shows where award shows win awards.
Yeah.
Yeah, critics,
that's what they need to do. They need to give an award for the best award show of the year.
Well, they do on the Emmys.
They do, don't they?
They do.
Yeah, that's true. That's why I never watched. That's why I never watched the Emmys.
The Emmys. Very good slip.
We want to go through some of these categories and
let's do that. Let's.
Okay, I've got the trusted ballot.
You
right
have
here.
The ballots with you. Wait a second.
And the nominees are.
Yes. Let's start with screenplays.
Okay. Let me get down to that on my screen here. Hold on.
All right. Get ready, Jerry. Come on.
I'm getting
get
ready.
Get
some slack, man.
I gotta get to it too. Where is it? Oh, there we go.
I'm starting at the bottom, I think, of the actual ballot. Let's start with the original screenplay.
Sounds good.
And the nominees for original screenplay are Juno, Diablo Cody. Lars and the Real Girl, Nancy Oliver, Michael Clayton, Tony Gilroy, Ratatouille, Brad Bird, and The Savages, Tamara Jenkins. Keith, we're going to open this up to you. You're a special guest tonight, and you can tell me who you think will win and who deserves to win. Okay? But wait for the drum roll, okay?
Okay.
We have a sound effects budget, so let me find this drum roll here. Here we go.
Ding! And I think what will win probably is Juno, which is fine with me. I'm not really a Juno detractor. I don't think it's the greatest thing ever, but I kind of dig it. And for me, as long as The Savages doesn't get jack shit, I'll be very happy because I really don't like The Savages whatsoever.
Oh wow! Wow!
Wow! Really?
What's your problem with The Savages?
I can think of tortures in hell more preferable to watching Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman play act sibling rivalry. It's basically how I would say it. But beyond that, beyond their extremely actory performances, which just annoy the hell out of me.
Do you have a sick parent or?
I actually, you know what? I had a sick grandfather who was in a nursing home, very much like the one that they portray in that. And to a degree, at least externally, I think she got that right.
Oh, she got a lot of that right.
That said, there's all this other stuff in there, like the whole jazz singer interlude, which I just found so out of place and so obvious in what it was trying to say.
I understood that, the point that she was making with that. Because all you have to do is really go back to the slums of... It's almost like I have to... It really is just a sequel to the slums of Beverly Hills.
Right.
And
which I haven't seen, to say, so, you know.
Okay, but... It's the movie. I like the movie, although it is a very. I was tempted to walk out several times during The Savages because it hit too close to home.
That's always great praise. That's always a great.
No, no, and I mean
I was tempted to walk out several times.
Jamie, I really could not watch parts of this. There's a scene on an airplane that I could not watch. I really had to turn away because it's very disturbing and it hit close to the reality that I live in right now. But I will say this, Juno is going to win and probably should win, but if Juno wasn't nominated, I would give it to The Savages, hands over fist. Even over Lars and The Real Girl, which I like a lot, and Michael Clayton, I would give it to The Savages.
Yeah. And I will say for The Savages that I thought Philip Bosco was very good in it, albeit...
That's a great performance from him.
There are films like that, though, and Keith, I'm sure you can... testify to this. I mean, you can't kind of argue with Jerry's take on The Savages because it hit a kind of personal note with him. There's some movies like that you can see their faults in a way, but at the same time, they're so personal to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that must be tough as a critic to kind of be able to distance yourself from that, to view the film kind of objectively in a way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you search online for one of my older reviews on this site, formerly called Culture Dust of the Hours, I gave that the highest rating on that site, which I think was 5 stars at the time, and I wrote an entirely personal essay about how The Hours sort of reflected my relationship with my mother, and
mm-hmm.
I sort of went and did that, and I kind of in some ways regret that review, think I probably could have done a better job of talking about the movie, which I think probably does have its problems, but at the same time it hit such a personal chord that film that I kind of even don't want to go back to it. I've not been able even to revisit it because the experience of watching it the first time out was so painful, even though it. I think I agree with more of the people who say it's just sort of a crappy kind of melodrama, but I'm not really sure, and I'm not really at that point where I feel like I can revisit to check it out. All I can say then is that I should just go around admitting that that's the case, you know, and just saying, well, this is where I am right now. It's certainly likely to change at some point.
I agree with you.
Yeah,
I've always wondered about that. Someone that writes criticism often, how you can kind of detach yourself from that. Yeah, we all have these movies that touch our heart in a certain way, in spite of their faults. I think Stallone's Cobra is the one for me. Chris, what do you think about the screenplay? Original screenplay? You think Juno's got it?
Yeah, I think Juno's got it, and it deserves it for me, too. I'd give it to Juno. I liked it. I thought it was, you know, good enough screenplay to make me want to go and see it twice because it was, you know, that quirky enough. I agree with Keith. I don't think it's the best thing, you know, since sliced bread like some people do. But as far as, you know, like dynamic screenplays this year that seemed original, I'd give it to Juno.
Go ahead,
Keith.
No, I was going to say, I actually wish the Aqua Teen Hunger Force movie had gotten original screenplay.
Oh, if that got it, well, this would be a different ballgame, folks.
but that's in another universe that couldn't possibly ever exist.
I couldn't stop laughing during that film, but...
I think the Juno, and we've talked about this in previous weeks, I think it has an original voice, and I think of all the films this year, it is definitely a product of its... a writer. I mean, it belongs to that writer in a way. And I like how the film offers these little nice surprises throughout, these character turns that kind of take you off guard, you know, and for all the, we've talked about this, for all the kind of ways that she can express herself so confidently, and then that moment of just nakedness when she says, I don't know what kind of girl I am.
Yeah, that's a great scene.
Yeah, or the idea of the parents, that the adoptive parents that aren't as perfect together as they seem to be on the outset. There are all these little nice little surprises that if a movie can surprise you in any way, yeah. I mean, you know, that's an accomplishment.
And I actually did get... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, man.
No, I was going to say that I got to interview Diablo Cody or basically sit in a round table with her, and it did seem that basically this was a person who really had her, you know, voice through the screenplay represented. You know, and I liked that point that you made, actually, that it's one of the screenplays here that really has... her voice. Whether you agree with that voice or not, of course, is debatable, but, you know, I mean, nonetheless, it is very much her individual voice.
We're going to talk about director later, too, but I thought that Reitman, I mean, he's nominated, but
yes.
His greatest strength in this film seemed to have been to be smart enough to get out of the writer's way. I mean, you know, to not intrude as little as possible, you know.
Indeed.
Just kind of let this work speak for itself. So we're all in agreement that Juno will win.
Yeah.
And seems to be the one that should win out of the nominees.
Hmm.
Adapted screenplay, Atonement from Christopher Hampton, Away from Her from Sarah Polley, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly from Ronald Harwood, No Country for Old Men, Joel and Ethan Coen, There Will Be Blood, P.T. Anderson. Jerry, what do we think here? Anytime, Jerry. Are you there, Jerry? Chris, are you there?
Yeah,
I'm here. Yeah.
Okay, Chris, what do you think about this category?
I think that they're going to give it to P.T. Anderson on this one, even though obviously it doesn't follow the Upton Sinclair book exactly or even very closely, I think that's even more reason to give it to it, because the category is best writing screenplay based on material previously published. You know, it doesn't have to follow it closely. And in terms of that, I think it's the biggest achievement in this category. I love No Country for Old Men, but that screenplay is really just kind of cutting and pasting from the book. There's not much in that movie that was not exactly the same way in the book. So
it's just a visual, a realization of what that book was, mm-hmm. what was best about that book.
Yeah, no, and I don't want to downplay that. I love that movie. But in terms of a real achievement in screenplay writing, I think There Will Be Blood really stands out in this category.
Okay. Jerry, are you with us, sir?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I'm glad you're there, man. What are your thoughts on this category? Who do you think will win?
I do agree with Chris to an extent, and I do agree with him because the Coen brothers won the Directors Guild Award, so I think they're going to get it for directing. They might give it to P.T. Anderson for screenplay.
Spread the wealth, yeah.
Yeah, but, and this is a big but, I think it might actually not even be between the two of them. This might be between the Diving Bell and the Butterfly and Atonement.
Who in your heart of hearts would you choose out of these, personally?
For this one, you really want to crucify me here. I would, I would go with Atonement.
You go with Atonement.
That's quite an achievement to adapt an Ian McEwan novel. That's quite an achievement.
Okay. Didn't people say the same thing about Cormac McCarthy, though, with No Country?
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, these are all five of these films are incredible. It's very hard to pick just one.
It would be interesting if they sort of went for the Alzheimer's Awards for both screenplays. If they went for Away From Her for adapted and The Savages for original.
Oh, God, yeah, I mean...
I mean, sometimes they have weird, like, you know, themes like that. Like,
yeah.
You sort of see where the guiltiness comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
In some ways. I don't necessarily know that it's going to go that way. I mean, the adapted screenplay is a very strong category.
It is.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
I mean, me personally, I'd love for There Will Be Blood to get it because I really love that movie.
Oh, it's my favorite movie of the year.
So, I mean, I guess... We'll see. And I haven't yet seen Away From Her, and I need to get around to that at some point. But.
Away From Her is great. Away From Her is one of these stories that seem to be so personal to her from what I've read.
Mm-hmm.
And
I love Sarah Polley. Yeah.
Yeah, she's great. And her direction is amazing.
Hmm.
And she lets her actors just live in these roles. I mean, she's, like we said, staying out of the way, you know, not imposing any kind of definite kind of style flourishes. It's all about the honesty of these people and the situation they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are beautiful moments in Away From Her. And no one ever talks about the lead actor. And I can't even.
Gordon Vincent?
Yes. He's amazing in this movie.
Yes, he is.
And Julie Christie's getting all the ink on the film, which is deserved. I mean, she's Julie Christie, and she's got this, such an ethereal kind of quality she always has. She's beautiful in the movie, but he was very strong. It's just two really strong lead characters in this kind of real-life situation, and you sympathize with them both, and you're on this journey with them, fully committed and fully involved. I think it's a strong effort from her. I don't think it'll win. I think that No Country is going to take it.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Chris about this, and Chris kind of has the opposite viewpoint as I do. But in terms of There Will Be Blood, it's a remarkable achievement. But I see Upton Sinclair's book Oil as just the initial seed, you know, the inspiration for what he made There Will Be Blood. It's not a true adaptation. It's like you start from that initial spark, and you go do your own thing, you know. In terms of a truthful adaptation of what that original source material is, I would go for No Country.
But that's not really what the category is, though. The category is best writing on material, you know, for a screenplay based on material. It's not necessarily who did the best adaptation. They've just sort of split the writing into two different categories and sort of said, okay, these are written directly for the screen, but this, yes, you wrote this, but you took it from someone else's work. So it's not really about if I understand it correctly, who did the best adaptation?
And actually, speaking of splitting, one of the things that a few people have said is they wonder if There Will Be Blood and No Country will split votes in a lot of ways, and then one of the others will sort of sneak in somewhere along those lines. In which case, would they go for the Oscar bait with Atonement, or, you know, would they go for the disability with The Diving Bell,
or
the Alzheimer's with Away From Her? I mean, you know, I believe they're, you know, it's sort of like you can reduce it, I think, in some way to what subject will most, you know, attract the Academy voters in some ways.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
That's a good point.
It's a crapshoot. It's a crapshoot.
Yeah.
So.
All of it is, really. I mean, we have a caller on the line. Let's get their take on some of this stuff. I believe it's John. I think we're looking at 817 area code. Let me see. 817, go ahead.
I always like when someone chuckles my name whenever they say, I think it's John.
It is John, yeah.
Hey, man.
I really think that when the Oscars come around, they need to have a special award for Philip Seymour Hoffman for being in every damn movie that
The Tommy Lee Jones Award.
Yeah, the Samuel Jackson Award. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, the honorary Samuel L. Jackson Award. To be just Samuel Jackson in his Pulp Fiction get up and the Oscar have a nice little pro.
I don't want these motherfuckers.
God, the guy showed up to my seat whenever I went to the theater. He was everywhere.
Yeah. Isn't that something about Sam Jackson, though? Because I remember when he came to prominence, you know, we knew him from, you know, Jungle Fever is probably the first major thing. And then we see him in every movie we've seen previous to that. It's like, yeah, he was in Goodfellas. Yeah, he's in everything.
Andrew.
Yeah.
Philip Seymour Hoffman cloned himself, and you know, the imperfect clone that came out with that bushy mustache is what you saw in Charlie Wilson's War.
Yeah. So, do you have any particular favorites this year, or a particular movie that you thought got snubbed?
I haven't seen No Country for Old Men, but I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan. Again, I want to see There Will Be Blood. Atonement. I mean, you remember The Critic, that cartoon show where they made fun of it with, like, Merchant Ivory presents the tea cozy? It's just like this really boring looking period drama. I don't need that.
But it's actually it's an anti masterpiece theater kind of movie. It's made for people.
A fantastic tracking shot, but you know, that's fine. I mean, now it's like the tracking shot's almost a cliche.
Right.
Kuron did an amazing one, and you know,
if it was up to me, John, I'd just give everything to There Will Be Blood and I'd, you know, get ready for next year.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, I also think that it's always happened every single year, but they still overlook, you know, comedies. And I really think that Knocked Up should have got at least the screenwriters.
Oh, I agree.
You know, I mean, but I think the second that you put anywhere in any script fake Katherine Heigl vagina, then it just kills your chances, right?
Yeah, I think you're right.
I have my kid here. He's 10, and he actually wanted to weigh in a little bit if you guys can indulge him here for a second.
There's no better robot fight than any movies except for Transformers.
That's, you know, that was our next category.
That was our visual
thinking about, yeah, like the robot fight in There Will Be Blood, so I don't think you like
it. Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
John, did you get
Prime going head-to-head with Daniel Plainview now?
John, did you get to, just let me ask you this before we go, did you get to see Zodiac?
Yes, I did, and that was snubbed. Really, really good movie. I think a lot of people probably were expecting to see 7 Part 2, which would have looked really weird on a poster, 7-2. But
yeah.
Obviously, that's not what they got. But Fincher, just every time he comes out in the movie, he just continues to show you that he's got a handle on his craft.
Yes, he does.
Made Mark Buffalo interesting to me. I mean,
that's my number one snub, and actually, my number one snub within Zodiac is Mark Ruffalo. An amazing performance, I thought. And I thought top to bottom, Chris and Jerry and I have been talking about this all year. We said this is a March release, so they're going to forget about it by Oscar time, but they shouldn't.
They didn't forget about Silence of the Lambs, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
you put something out too early, and then nobody remembers it. It's tragic. But.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, we'll just have to wait until the Movie Geeks United Award show to compensate Zodiac. But thank you, John, for calling in, man.
No problem, guys. Have a good night.
You too.
Thank you, buddy. Bye-bye. Keith, do you feel that a movie like Zodiac is an obvious snub? What were your thoughts on that one?
Well, it is in a sense, although I will say personally I was not really a fan. The movie kind of bored me. At the same point, I do respect it in terms of Fincher's development, I think. It just wasn't something that I particularly had much, it didn't really resonate with me. So,
Well, you're definitely not alone. I had a throwdown with someone a couple of weeks ago on another show about Zodiac.
Touches? Yeah.
Really?
I did.
Or was it a stalemate?
What's that, buddy?
Was it a stalemate, or did you win, or who won the argument?
Jerry, who do you think, I was part of the fight.
I think you won, because those guys are just talking out of their ass as far as I'm concerned.
Brilliant.
All right. So some of these other, let's go through some of these technical very quickly. Achievement and visual effects, we have The Golden Compass, Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, and Transformers.
Pirates of the Caribbean will win, probably. I mean, it just makes sense, I think. The Golden Compass, first of all, is just god-awful, and, and then Transformers, I don't know. Has a Michael Bay film ever won a technical award? It probably has.
I'm sure it has. I don't know. Yeah. It's between Transformers or Pirates. Aren't they both ILM, though? So I guess it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I just have a feeling Pirates is the more obvious choice, because it's the third film, and, it's just like, I think they'll just award that, so.
Yeah. Do you think the quality of the actual film plays in to these awards? Or is it just...
I can't really think of any example from the past where the quality of a film and its visual effects have been, synonymous in whatever way. Unless,
right.
I don't know,
well,
Classic
Jurassic
Titans
Park.
Got something. Oh, yeah, Jurassic Park. Sure, I love Jurassic Park. So,
Why don't we just skip over the technical awards and get to the main meat here?
You want to get to the main meat, Jerry? You want to skip sound mixing and all this? You want to skip... Norbit is not.
What about What about like best catering? Why isn't that?
The sound guys work hard. So,
no, they all do work hard. No, we should. All right. I mean,
they
deserve. Let's give everyone their due. Let's go to. I think Transformers will get visual effects. It's like here. What do they call it? 5 cents of one, 10 cents of the other. What's that phrase?
Like that.
Six of one, half dozen of the other.
Exactly. Thank you. Let's go to sound mixing.
Okay.
The Bourne Ultimatum, No Country for Old Men, Ratatouille, 3:10 to Yuma, and Transformers.
I say No Country. I think that might be one of those. Just they give it the technical awards and stuff, and deserves it. I mean, if for nothing else, it silences, which...
Exactly.
I'm with you there.
Yeah, and this movie has been renowned on the first half hour of kind of nothing but silence, and very sparse, no musical score, I don't think, right? Is it for No Country?
I think you're right. Yeah.
I don't remember a musical score.
I think there's a very little bit of score by Carter Burwell somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But it might just be the credits, so, yeah.
Right. I would have no problem with No Country. I think it's going to go to the big robot movie again, though, or Bourne Ultimatum. I think it's going to go to the movie that has the most kind of sound. I mean, the most bombastic. I think they'll give it to the most bombastic of the bunch.
So do you think that's true with sound editing as well?
Sound editing might might be a good argument for No Country for Old Men.
Or There Will Be Blood. There's no.
Or There Will Be Blood. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Chris, do you have any views on sound editing or sound mixing? I think they're all other than okay. We have a difference here between mixing and editing. Editing has all the same nominees, but it takes no 3:10 to Yuma and replaces it with There Will Be Blood. So we have Bourne Ultimatum, No Country, Ratatouille. There Will Be Blood, Transformers for sound editing.
Yeah, I've got this up in front of me. I got to say, I think they'll give it to Bourne because there's a lot of love for this movie, not only by the audiences, but by Hollywood, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was a pretty big achievement in terms of sound and in editing, too. But I think they're going to go with Bourne because they want to give it something, I think. It's a really, really strong movie.
Oh, it is, yeah.
It is, and it's one of those that they don't recognize in the top five kind of categories, but it was just as accomplished because of the genre it's in. I think that it was just as accomplished as any other film this year. in terms of delivering in that particular genre. Okay, let's go to our next category.
Now, the short films are the next ones, right?
Yeah, have we seen any of these short films?
I haven't seen any of them.
I can tell you, just in the animated short film, I have seen Peter and the Wolf by Susie Templeton,
right.
Which I actually linked as the link for the day yesterday on The House Next Door, because it's actually online. And I would really recommend you all check that out. It's 29 minutes long. It's stop-motion animation, no dialogue, and entirely scored with the Prokofiev music, except
cool.
for the first 6 minutes, which are silent and just sort of set up the world of Peter and the Wolf. But it's a really terrific film, and having only seen that, it would be great if that got awarded, but, usually the short films, they do screen them in New York, I know, for, like, critics and other people. I think at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, they usually tend to do it
right.
a week and a half, 2 weeks before the ceremony. So, you know, if you all are in that area or you know anyone who wants to be able to catch it, that's where you'd catch it. So,
you know, and I saw with the Sundance Festival this year that they actually put up their short films on their website, didn't they?
Yeah.
For the Sundance Festival.
And you never know. You never know. You might be able to find these online, too. It's probable. So, I mean, you know, there you go.
let's go to the music categories. Now, this is
okay.
Achievement of Music written for motion pictures, like original song. Falling Slowly from Once. Happy Working Song from Enchanted. Raise It Up from August Rush. So Close from Enchanted. And That's How You Know from Enchanted.
Right.
Jerry, what do you think here?
I think anything from Enchanted.
You think?
I mean, it's got to get something. It's really got to get...
Chris, what do you think?
I think I don't give a shit, actually. It's just one of those categories I really wish they'd get rid of. It just doesn't mean anything to me.
Unless Trey Parker and Matt Stone, you know, do another song. But.
Yeah,
once in a while, every couple of years, there'll be one song in here that really is deserving of some sort of recognition. But other than that, and this year is a perfect example, it really is just sort of repetitive and not necessary, I think. No one's really listening to these songs. It's just not important. But maybe they'll give it to Enchanted.
Yeah, I think I got to give Enchanted something. So this is the category to do it.
Yeah, but then again, Once is such a beloved kind of movie. And this is the place where it's represented on here.
Right.
Yeah, although I read on Jim Emerson's Scanner's blog that there might be some controversy over Once getting nominated and if it's eligible now or something.
Why?
Yeah,
why
I don't know.
That?
I'm going to pull that up while you guys keep talking. I'm going to see if
I can
find out why.
Well, it's listed as a 2006 movie. I think it did screen in some places in 2006. So I just
wondering. Oh, is that the controversy? Okay.
I believe so.
I think they're going to give it to That's How You Know from Enchanted.
I think so too.
I did like Enchanted, and looking at these nominations, that's the only one that I can hear in my head out of these titles.
Right.
And that accounts for something, I would think.
We've based the Best Song Award on what Jamie can recount.
What I have in my head, yeah, what I can't stop humming.
Well,
I do sing it every night. Go ahead.
And according to Jim Emerson's blog, it seems that the song in question from Once might have been written and performed before it was in the movie, before it was finished. Now, why it's becoming an issue now that after the fact is I don't know. I don't know why, but you know that's just something to take a look at. You can access Jim's site through RogerEbert.com because Jim is Roger's editor. So
that's right. Mm-hmm. And actually, the big controversy about Score, which we're about to get to,
right.
With There Will Be Blood.
I
guess it contains pre-existing.
Yeah, so they took that out.
So
original score, we're looking at Atonement, The Kite Runner, mm-hmm. Michael Clayton, Ratatouille. And 3:10 to Yuma. Chris, you don't give a shit about this one either, right?
Well, no, that's not true. I do. I think Score definitely adds something to a movie. And I got to go with Ratatouille on this one. I think they're going to give it to it because, again, it's a movie that there was a lot of love for, and none of these scores really stick out in my mind. But I do know some of Michael Giacchino's music from Lost, and I think he's pretty talented. So, like we said before, crapshoot, I'll take Ratatouille.
Yeah. Keith, what do you think?
Oh, see, I wish it was 1987 because I just watched Alex Cox's Walker yesterday, which has this amazing score by Joe Strummer. Of course, I'm sure it wouldn't have even been nominated then, but you know, that score has been obsessing my mind. So, quite frankly, I'm looking at all these and even the ones that I've seen that were, you know, perfectly fine, you know, Ratatouille and 3:10 to Yuma and stuff, just like aren't making that much of an impression on me because I got the damn Joe Strummer score in my head. But
yeah.
I mean, for this, I'd say I don't really know what will win, honestly, but I mean, I do remember 3:10 to Yuma's score being very well done and suited to that particular film. So I'd almost say I'd like that to win because I thought that you know, that complemented that particular movie very well. So
yeah. Did you see Walker the New Criterion? Is that where you saw it?
Yeah. It's an amazing movie. Such an incredible movie.
It's a great film.
Yeah.
Jerry, what do you think? You're going for Atonement, right?
I think it would be, for me, I like all five scores, but it would be between The Kite Runner and Atonement, which are both films have great scores. Obviously, The Kite Runner has Iglesias' soundtrack, which he does a lot of great scores, but it belongs to Atonement. Of the five scores, that is the most memorable and the best. I mean, I've been listening to either that or There Will Be Blood for the last 2 months.
You know, and there is something to be said, too, for it's the one score here that's most kind of sweeping.
It's
one of those scores that they love. It's the period piece, the sweeping, romantic, you know, ecstasy score. I think that they're going to go with Atonement.
I think that if it wins anything, that's where it's going to win.
Yeah. Olivia Rose, we're talking about makeup now. Olivia Rose, Norbit. How do those belong in the same category? Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. Keith, give it your best shot.
It would be great if Le'Veon Rose got it. I'm a real big fan of that film, and I think how Marion Cotillard and the makeup artist work together to, you know, give this impression of Edith Piaf is just incredible.
Yeah.
I haven't seen either of the others. And according to Armand, of course, I probably should see Norbit, but we'll see if that happens anytime soon.
Why, does he like it?
Oh, Armand loves Norbit, yeah. Armand White loves Norbit.
His opinion, my opinion of him goes down with each minute of my life.
No, Armand has a good defense of it, and he is a good defense of Eddie Murphy, I think. But, you know, I mean, but nonetheless, I mean,
Have you carried on any dialogue with Armand White? Have you met him on any occasions?
I met him, like, a few years ago, and we say hi to each other at screenings and stuff, but I remember we went out to dinner once, and it was around the time Moulin Rouge was out, and I admitted I kind of liked Moulin Rouge, and he jokingly picked up a ketchup bottle and said, "Okay, now we got to fight." I was like, "Oh, okay."
Right.
So he's got a sense of humor about things. But you know.
Well, that's good, because I remember we had him on for the De Palma, and
yeah.
I can always tell if a movie is universally panned, I can almost predict that he will find some value in it.
Or universally praised, this is 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days review.
Absolutely.
Has shown. However, I don't like that movie either, so he and I, it's kind of he and me against the world, I guess.
Yeah. But at least he has a sense of humor about it. That's great, because I remember some if anyone would kind of confront Pauline Kael and say that they liked a movie that she really didn't like, that she would get very, very combative.
Yeah,
that's what I've read. Best foreign language film.
Yes.
I've seen none of those.
I think I have an idea who will win.
You know, and again, it's another controversy. 4 months wasn't eligible for some stupid reason, and you know, and then I think one of these is Giuseppe Tornatore, who a lot of people say is just a Miramax kind of, you know,
it's not gonna be a foreign film guy.
Yeah,
I know who's going to win.
Who do you, Jerry?
I think it's going to be Kat Yin, the Polish one. There's a big article in The Economist about it this week. And
okay.
I think that's the one they're going to go with. About the Soviets kill all the Polish soldiers under Stalin's command. And I think that's where I think the energy is right now. I will tell you, though, this morning I saw a movie that they thought would be eligible but wasn't. There's a big controversy about it, The Band's Visit from Israel.
Right, right.
Yeah.
If that was nominated, that would win because it's a very fluff but a very entertaining piece.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the reason it wasn't nominated because, like, half of it's in English. But that would, you know, I would think of if this other one, this other Israeli film, Beaufort, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I think that if The Band's Visit was nominated, that would win, but it's not. And it's a crapshoot. But I'm going with Cat in just because that's where all the energy is right now.
It would have been so much easier if they just put the diving bell and the butterfly in
the
category
as well.
And then it would be like, oh, okay, well, now we know.
Yeah,
you're right.
I agree.
You're right.
Keith, I agree with you 100%.
Let's try to swim through these. Achievement in these other categories here. Achievement in film editing. We're looking at The Bourne Ultimatum, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Into the Wild, No Country for Old Men, and There Will Be Blood. Film editing. Chris, you have an opinion on this one?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Bourne Ultimatum again on this one because it's pretty striking. And you know, in terms of editing an action movie, I think they did a really great job. So that's my choice.
Okay. Keith, what do you think?
I have this feeling that No Country and There Will Be Blood are going to split this category. So then it's between the other three. I'd almost say it would be interesting if it went with Into the Wild, which I haven't seen, but which a lot of people I know really like a lot. If that wouldn't be sort of like a token acknowledgement in some way. So I'm going to go with that.
Yeah, I think so too, and I can also see where it might be Diving Bell and the Butterfly as well, because I don't think that it'll be well represented in what it wins in other categories.
Right.
And obviously I live in Florida, so we haven't been able to see Diving Bell and the Butterfly, but from everything I've read of it, it's really about the way it's shot and the perspective that it's shot in that's very unique, and I think that they'll probably give the editing award to that film as recognition.
I think you may be right, Jamie. When we saw it, a guy walked out because he thought there was something wrong with the film. He didn't realize this was because it was from the point of view of the stroke victim in the film.
Yeah,
and he didn't realize that. And a couple people walked out because they thought there's something wrong with the film.
Yeah, so if a movie that fools you into thinking there's something wrong with it, technically, I think they should give the technical award.
Right.
There you go.
Have we seen any of the documentary short subject films?
I've seen Sari's Mother, which I hadn't seen any of Longley's other movies.
Is that
movies,
about
like
Katie Holmes?
Which one?
Is that about Katie Holmes?
Oh, for God's sake! yes, no, it's an Iraq movie with Katie Holmes. Yeah, it's basically about a young boy who was part of the Iraq and Fragments document, or was going to be part of it, but who we put into this little short documentary, and the young boy contracted AIDS, I think, as I recall, through needles or something else, and so it's about the mother trying to, you know, find medicine and other things for the boys, and just sort of documenting their daily life. So I mean, I don't know in comparison to the others, but certainly I wouldn't be surprised if they go with something like that. So
well, it seems like it definitely is a documentary of relevance. I think if we're looking at the documentary nominees, shouldn't that be a real consideration? How relevant this material is and these themes explored are?
Well, relevant to the Academy voters, and, you know, good luck getting inside their heads sometimes. sometimes it's easier than others, but, you know.
And that's what I'm thinking about for documentary feature.
Yeah.
Because we have No End in Sight, Operation Homecoming, Writing the Wartime Experience, Sicko, okay. Taxi to the Dark Side, and War Dance. I think in terms of the film that has received the most kind of universal praise and attention, and it is incredibly relevant to today, and No End in Sight. I think that's one of the givens of the night, that No End in Sight will take it home.
I think I'd agree with that. I mean, Moore has already gotten one, and I don't know, you know, it just doesn't feel like he's going to get that again. And then as far as the others, I mean, they're pretty much all Iraq War documentaries, except for War Dance, I think.
I think War Dance is going to get it.
You think War Dance
Do
is going to get it?
Oh, because there's a lot of momentum around here. I live in a documentary town, Washington, D.C., okay. And they're from Washington, D.C., the filmmakers. and there's a lot of energy behind this film right now. Sadly, it only played around here for a couple of weeks. I didn't get to see it, but it is actually, because it is outside of the, it's not about Iraq, and so it might not cancel out the others,
right?
Which are about this. I wouldn't rule it out. Let's put it like that.
Okay, and Chris, you're in agreement as well about no end in sight, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
I would give it to that. I'm just saying I wouldn't rule out War Dance. So there's just a lot of momentum lately behind it.
Okay, you could be proven correct.
I don't think so. Come on, I'm never proven correct. I mean, I said Drew Williams would be nominated for for things to do in Denver when you're dead, so what do I know?
Oh, so what are we listening to anything?
Yeah, why are you listening to me? Why do you even have me on the show? I mean, I've been pretty
No. We love you, man. Stick around.
Thank you.
Achievement in costume design, Across the Universe, Atonement, Elizabeth the Golden Age, Levian Rose, Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. Keith, you have a favorite here?
I don't really know about favorite, but I just feel like maybe this will be the token Elizabeth the Golden Age given, because the costumes in that are pretty striking, and, you know, I mean, that's pretty much all the movie is. It's Cate Blanchett, as one of my writers said, looking like a quill pen holder for 2 hours. So, you know, I mean, that's really that movie's sole reason for being, so I'm going to go with that.
Chris, what do you think? Chris, are you there?
Chris?
All right. I think I can speak on behalf of Chris, because we talked about this last night, and I feel the same way. I think it'll go to Sweeney Todd.
I do, too.
I'd love it to go to Sweeney Todd. I love that movie. So.
I love it, too.
Yeah, but I don't discount Elizabeth. I mean, you're absolutely right. If they're sharing the wealth this year, I think that Elizabeth, that'll be its win. Achievement and art direction. We have American Gangster. Atonement, The Golden Compass, Sweeney Todd, and There Will Be Blood. Jerry, what do you think?
I'm gonna go with Sweeney Todd again.
Yeah. I would go with that too. What do you think, Keith?
I would say probably, and very much deservedly so, with Dante Ferretti. I mean, much as I also love Jack Fisk's work in general, just with his art direction, but I mean, and being Sissy Spacek's husband and all, but of course I'd love There Will Be Blood to get it as well, but sure, Sweeney Todd, I think, probably is the most striking of all that, so yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like the more obvious choice of all of them.
Yeah.
So I think we're all in agreement there. I think that Chris is, I'll monitor the phone lines to see when Chris comes back with us. His phone might have lost its charge. We're going over a little bit. Let's go to Best Animated Feature of the Year. We have Persepolis, Ratatouille, and Surf's Up.
And Aqua Teen Hunger Force, colon, movie film.
You're really pushing for that.
Sadly not. You have to listen to the audio commentary on that DVD.
I know, I need to get around to that.
Oh my God.
I love that film.
In the first minute, she compares it to both Simon of the Desert by Buñuel and Weekend by Godard. It's absolutely brilliant. So
okay, we got it. We'll do that tonight.
But okay, animated feature, please. go ahead.
I think the obvious is Ratatouille.
I think I've seen all three films, but I can honestly say I would give it to Ratatouille.
But
I'm gonna say Persepolis is a possibility here, just because of its pedigree.
Oh, I agree. You're right. I mean, you're on to something there.
You know, I mean, there's always the Disney picture, and certainly Ratatouille is great. I mean, especially everything with Peter O'Toole's character. But, Persepolis, I don't know. Again, it's trying to get inside the Academy's head. So as much as you can do dime store psychology, I mean, Persepolis, I think, has a lot of what they look for to give an award to.
Yeah,
I think it's gaining momentum too. For some reason, I get that sense that that the awareness of it is getting out there a lot more.
Good movie, great graphic novel. So go on.
Do you think because it didn't get the foreign film?
Yeah, that's another reason.
Here,
that's another reason. It's sort of like, you know, okay, we don't give it an award here, but we give it an award here.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like one of those things, and they do that a lot with the ones out of the top categories.
Right. That's true. That's
Chris,
true.
Do you think it's going to be Ratatouille? What do you think on this category?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure if enough people have seen Persepolis, you know, and I really don't believe that most of the voters actually watch all of the movies. So it's easy enough to give it. I really don't. I'm sorry.
I agree.
I agree with that, Chris. There's no argument.
Me too.
So I think it's easy enough to give it to Ratatouille, and it is a good movie, so why not?
Oh, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I honestly think that some of these categories, like the short subject or the animated short, or they look for the title that sounds the snappiest, and they say, okay, let's give it to that one.
I think that's right.
That's what we do. We predict the winner. So
yeah, that's true. Let's go with a performance by an actress in a supporting role.
What about cinematography? Do we want to do?
Yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to do that.
Let him go in his order.
Okay.
We're looking at Cate Blanchett and I'm Not There, Ruby Dee and American Gangster, Suarez Ronan, I think I pronounced it right, and Atonement, Amy Ryan and Gone Baby Gone, and Tilda Swinton and Michael Clayton. Keith, this is a tough one.
This is very tough.
Yeah, you know, if they go guilty, it's either going to be we're going to give it to the kid or the black woman.
He's right. He's absolutely right.
To be perfectly blunt about it, at the same time, they could also go, because Tilda Swinton and Cate Blanchett, you know, they both have that kind of weird alien quality, although I love Tilda, and Cate kind of annoys me a lot of the time. But
he's
already
won. Cate's won. I would give it to Tilda, but that's just me.
Yeah, no, I'd give it to Tilda for anything, because, you know,
she's
just awesome.
Yeah,
you know?
She is.
And I'm actually kind of surprised that Vanessa didn't get it here.
That's
for,
a good
for
point.
Atonement. You know, but then again, I mean, whatever. You know, Vanessa has gotten plenty of notice. Well, actually, maybe it's because we're Zionist hoodlums comment from many years ago.
It might be, you know, dude, that will do it.
Then again, this is the only recognition that Gone Baby Gone has received in this awards.
Yeah, so then they could go with that as well. But I'm going to lean on the Academy prejudices going to the kid or the black woman, and for some reason I feel like Ruby Dee is going to get it.
I think Ruby Dee is going to get it, too.
Yeah, you think Ruby Dee, Jerry, too?
Yeah, I really do. Since that's come out, there's a lot of momentum, because just using the rationale from Gone Baby Gone, because American Gangster didn't get really any awards. So it's really, I think it's between the two of those, to be honest with you.
You know, I switch my opinion on this every day. So this is my opinion on this category today, and I guess I got to stick with it.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
When it comes to the big surprises, a lot of times they occur in the supporting categories. I think that it's going to go to Amy Ryan. I think that's going to be like the first. I think it's probably one of the first awards that are announced typically in the Oscars. I think they're going to open up with a big surprise and they're going to give it to Amy Ryan.
I think that's a good point.
Who's going to be leading that? Who won last year for supporting actor?
Oh, don't do that to me.
I have no idea. I forgot to, but.
Well, as long as it's not Jack Palance. Well, Jack Palance can't do it, but
Beyond the grave, Jack Palance. God.
Chris, what are your... I'm sorry, Keith, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think you might be onto something with Amy Ryan, too, because Cate Blanchett and Tilda Swinton are comparable in this category, as are Ruby Dee and Saoirse Ronan, you know, just in terms of, like, the Academy prejudice sort of thing, like, you know, each of those are similar, so Amy Ryan is sort of the odd girl out here. And
then last night, Chris and I were talking, and I was saying Tilda Swinton, only because that'll be the one award I think Michael Clayton wins out of all of these nominations. And Ruby Dee was a real wrench that they threw in here. And I think it has more to do with her status as, I mean, she's been in the industry forever. I mean, she's 82 years old. I think it has more to do with her age than, you know, the child of the black woman. I think it's the child or the old lady, the old veteran.
There you go.
Alan Arkin won last year. Thank you, Mike and Alex, for.
Yeah, but I'm going with Amy Ryan. What about you, Chris?
I'm going to go with the early favorite. I think Cate Blanchett's going to win it. I think the Academy loves her, and I think that's going to be the surprise, that they're not going to go with these people that are getting the momentum right now. I think they love her enough to give it to her again, even though she won this category just a couple years ago. I think it's going to happen again.
So they'll give it to her every year she's nominated?
Yeah.
Well, they didn't give it to her for Elizabeth.
Let's go with Best Actress. We're looking at Cate Blanchett and Elizabeth, The Golden Age, Julie Christie in Away From Her, Marianne Cotillard in Livian Rose, Laura Linney in The Savages. We already know Keith's opinion on that.
Yeah, we know it's down the toilet.
Ellen Page in Judo. What do we think, Jerry? What do we think about that?
Julie Christie.
You think so?
Yeah, and if she doesn't win, that's the upset.
What do you think, Chris?
I think that they're going to give it to Julie Christie. I think there's enough love for her and this movie and this performance. And it's never gone away since it first came out. That's what they've been talking about. And
yeah.
I think it's she's going to take it.
Keith, do you feel differently?
I think Cotillard, actually, because I believe Christie has won, correct, in the past?
For what was Dr. Zhivago, maybe? Or?
No, I don't think she's won for that. I'll look it up. But
Or Darling or something?
I don't think she won for...
And just, I like what Cotillard does in Livian Rose a lot, but at the same time, I do acknowledge that it has all the surface ticks and stuff that I think the Academy would go for. Not to mention, this is one of the few examples, I think Sophia Loren was the only other one, where a foreign film, or what the Academy deems a foreign film, actually breaks through into the top categories.
Well, Roberto Benigni as well.
You're absolutely
that,
right.
That was, talk about an upset. Talk about a shocker. I mean, that was definitely one.
Yeah.
You know,
he won for Darling.
I don't think Marion's going to climb over the seats, though, if she wins.
No, I don't think she's going to do that either. But she won for Darling, so.
And Marion won the Golden Globe Best Actress.
She did, yeah. I mean, at the same time, of course, you know, Ellen Page does, I don't know, I doubt she'll win, but I mean, she does.
That would be a shock.
Yeah, that would be that. But she does have sort of the Schwab's drugstore discovery thing going for her. So it might be that, you know, and probably they wouldn't give it to her, but she probably does have a long career ahead of her because of that.
There, it is one of those performances like we want to recognize you. I mean, obviously it's a top performance, but there's the sentiment that she is just beginning. You know,
right.
So this is an encouragement to keep doing great work and wow us again, and we'll give you a supporting award down the line. You know,
that's
how
Daddy
I feel
Day
about
camp.
It. Chris, you went with Away From Her. Is that what you went with, Julie Christie?
Yeah, Julie Christie.
I go with Julie Christie too, but I do think that it's entirely plausible that Marianne Cotillard will win it.
Oh, I don't rule that out. I don't.
Yeah. We're going to go to the acting categories, and then we'll do. Then we'll do directing and cinematography, and then best picture in this last 20 minutes.
You're really going to watch me just...
performance by an actor in a supporting role, Casey Affleck. The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford doesn't fit real well on a marquee. Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Charlie Wilson's War, Hal Holbrook in Into the Wild, Tom Wilkinson and Michael Clayton. These categories are getting tougher and tougher.
Yeah, this is a very hard one.
Yeah, Keith, what's your opinion on this one?
As long as it's not that ham Tom Wilkinson, that'll be fine with me. But I'm going to say, you know, I'd say it's between Bardem and Holbrook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I haven't seen Into the Wild again, but everybody who I've talked to, whether they like his performance or not, has singled out Hal Holbrook in some shape or form as being very noticeable in it and very integral to the last 20 minutes of the movie or whatever it
is. Yeah, he is.
So I'd say, you know, there's that, and I guess, you know, again, sorry to go with the prejudices, but I guess it's the old man vote and stuff. And
You're right. I mean, that does factor in.
You know, so it's like, I'm sorry, what is it, the old man or the evil Hispanic? it's kind of like, what prejudice will the Academy go for? But, Javier Bardem, though, is, like, so menacing, too, and I think that, you know, as something like Hannibal Lecter proved, you know, they have they do have an eye out for the psychotics as well. So,
the supporting roles tend to go to the showier kind of performance, and of which I think that Philip Seymour Hoffman, I mean, any review I've read of Charlie Wilson's War, and you know, they always single out Philip Seymour Hoffman. They say it's the movie's fine, and I just saw the movie last night.
Mm-hmm.
But Philip Seymour Hoffman is the one to watch in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, I'm going to play it safe, and I'm going to say Javier Bardem. But I wouldn't take it. I wouldn't be surprised if Hal Holbrook took it. And then we have the dark horse. We have Casey Affleck, who's had a great year, as great a year as any actor.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And this is his recognition here in this nomination, so that could be an upset as well. Chris,
yeah.
What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think Javier Bardem will win it and should win it. I think, it's one of those performances that we're going to remember for a long time, whereas these other ones, I'm not so sure. But, I don't see it going any other way.
Okay. Performance by an actor in a leading role, George Clooney and Michael Clayton, Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood, Johnny Depp in Sweeney Todd, Tommy Lee Jones in The Valley of Elah, Viggo Mortensen in Eastern Promises. Jerry, what's your feeling here?
And this is like the best actress last year. It could go any way, but I think it belongs to Daniel Day-Lewis. It really does.
I think so too.
I could go with any of these performances. I would be happy if any of them won.
But doesn't, I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis has the kind of momentum now that it's out there, that this is a, and people aren't just saying it's a great performance. They're saying this is an earth-shattering, as good as anything that has been produced in the history of cinema in terms of a lead performance. That's the kind of raves you're hearing about this performance.
It is, he owns this category right now, but it's like last year, though, where I have to honestly say the best actress, any of those performances were worthy, and I feel that way about this year, but I just think this is Daniel Day-Lewis's year.
I would go Daniel Day-Lewis too, because it is a remarkable performance, and there's also the idea that he owns the movie. He doesn't share it with an ensemble. I mean, everyone is great in the movie, but
he doesn't share it. That's right.
He dominates the movie. Is my point.
Yeah, he does.
Keith, do you feel that way about Daniel Day? Will he take it?
I drink your milkshake. I drink your milkshake.
I mean, yeah, I drink it too.
Drink, Eli! Yeah. I go with Daniel Day-Lewis too as well. And looking at all of these, I mean, there's the George Clooney sort of marquee factor, but I think, probably Michael Clayton is not showy enough to get an award in this case. Johnny Depp, I think, does some great stuff in Sweeney Todd, actually. I think he's actually been very underrated for the movie.
He's wonderful in the film.
He's a much more internalized Sweeney than you would see on stage, and I think that actually works for the film.
Mm-hmm.
I hope to write an essay about that at some point, maybe, and look at that, and also There Will Be Blood, because I think I'd like to write about them both, because I haven't yet. And I haven't seen Tommy Lee in The Valley of Ella just because of my Paul Haggis,
it's a lot better than Crash.
Or whatever. Okay, well,
because I think Crash is a mediocre made for TV movie of the week. I mean,
okay. Yeah, and from what I understand, Tommy Lee Jones is pretty extraordinary in it anyway.
He's the movie. I mean, without him, you don't have a movie.
Yeah,
I think he's extraordinary in No Country. I mean,
I think Viggo's extraordary in Eastern Promises
as
well.
Yes, he is.
So, I mean, you know,
it's
but,
hard,
but that's
it's
just...
hard. It's hard to pick.
But that's just not one that's going to get it. I really don't think.
It just wasn't seen by many people, so...
Yeah, Chris, are you thinking Day-Lewis, right?
Oh, absolutely. I agree with Keith, though, about Johnny Depp. It's unfortunate that he won't win it this year, because he really was
quite wonderful in that
movie. But yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis, no question.
Yeah, I prefer this Depp performance to his Captain Jack, personally, but, you know...
Let's go with achievement in cinematography, which I think is the toughest category.
It is tough.
Mm.
The Assassination of Jesse James, Atonement, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, No Country for Old Men, and There Will Be Blood.
Sweet.
Chris, have your way at it.
It is a really tough one, but I got to go No Country just because they want to give it awards, and because it's such a tough category, it is a beautifully shot movie. And I can see them going with that for this one. And Roger Deakins, of course, you know, he's beloved. Why not?
Hmm. Yeah. Keith, what do you think?
Instinct says Deakins, too. I mean, Elswit does a really great job with There Will Be Blood, but, Kaminsky is, I think, one for Schindler's List, and if I'm not mistaken, or another of the Spielberg and stuff. Of course, he's a great DP, too. But I just feel like this is probably Deakins' year, so I'll go with No Country for that.
Yeah. Jerry, what do you think?
I can't call it. I really can't call it.
Okay, way to step up there, man.
Thanks. I knew you'd appreciate it.
I'm going to go with There Will Be Blood. But I wouldn't be surprised if it were The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, just like we were talking about. in the unique way in which it was shot. I think there's a stereotype here that, like, Kaminsky is Spielberg's guy, you know, where he's kind of been pigeonholed as that for the past few years. I read some kind of interview with a cinematographer where they say, you know, he's worked with all these different directors, and I think it's encouraging that he got recognized for this outside of a Spielberg film. But I think it's going to be There Will Be Blood. Let's go to directing. The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Julian Schnabel. Juno, Jason Reitman. Michael Clayton, Tony Gilroy. No Country for Old Men, Joel and Ethan Coen. And There Will Be Blood, Paul Thomas Anderson. Anyone want to chime in here?
Well, I'll go first and say that this is one of the ones where I feel like No Country and There Will Be Blood could really split it. And then you've got, God, you know, what if the upset were that Reitman won for Juno?
That would be an upset.
There will be blood. I'm just throwing that out there, you know, as like one of those real dark horse categories there. Because I don't think Tony Gilroy has got it from Michael Clayton. I just think that's Michael Clayton's just like, it's probably going to get shut out entirely.
It might.
Yeah, you weren't crazy about Michael Clayton, were you?
I hate Michael Clayton, but
did you really?
I did. The minute he ran into those Celestine Prophecy horses on the hill, I was just like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" Yeah.
Well, I love Michael Clayton, but I just think it belongs. If the Directors Guild thing today, or was it yesterday?
Yeah.
The Coen Brothers won. I think they are going to win it. So.
Yeah. No, and yeah.
I'm sorry, man. What do you think, Chris?
I agree with Keith in terms that they're going to split it on this one, but I think that they're going to split the picture and director category. I think P.T. Anderson's going to win Best Director here.
I think that it's going to be the Coen Brothers.
Okay.
Because I think that that they're due. They've been making films that have impressed audiences and critics, you know, to no end for so long.
And they've only won screenplay, correct? Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, they've never won a director prize, no.
Right, okay.
But it wouldn't surprise me about P.T. Anderson, but I'm going with my gut and thinking the Coen brothers just for their longevity that they have over P.T. Anderson.
Okay.
And that this recent movie is as good as anything that they've ever made. I mean, it's certainly as critically acclaimed as anything that they've ever produced. But in terms of Michael Clayton, I think you're right, Keith. I think it's going to get shut out completely. I think they nominate this movie because it's like so many other previous winners. It speaks to like the underdog against the system. You know, it's the kind of Norma Rae, Aaron Brockovich, even Rocky in a way. I mean, they deal with
that
kind of similar.
And it's got the sort of 70s patina too. That you know, if there's any like critical maxim that infects the Academy, I'd say it's probably that the 70s were a golden age. You know, that's probably something that a lot of the critical establishment and the Academy Awards people might say they agree on in some way and sort of try to promote. That's why I think
Kate Blanchett will win for the 70s, the golden age, actually.
Oh, God.
Man, we've been at it too long tonight. Let's go to our final category. Jerry, I got your opinion on that one, didn't I? Directing?
Yeah, yes, you did.
Okay.
Coen Brothers, so.
Coen Brothers. You and I are in total agreement. Best Picture. That's all that's left, right?
Yeah.
That's it.
The Big Dog. And I can't find it on my list. Hang on.
It's Atonement, Juno, Michael Clayton, No Country for Old Men, and There Will Be Blood.
Okay, Jerry, what do you think?
There Will Be Blood.
Chris?
I think There Will Be Blood is the best picture of the year. It's my favorite, but I think No Country is going to win it.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do.
You think?
Yeah, I think so. I think Juno's the dark horse, but I think No Country is going to take it.
And Keith, what do you think?
Crash. No. Actually, yeah, that would be great if Nicholson announced that again. Again, I'm feeling like there's going to be a split thing here, and there might be one of those weird upset things where you're holding your red wine at the end of the night, and you're like, No Country, There Will Be Blood, No Country, There Will Be Blood, and then they'll go like, Juno, You're like, what?
I'd have no problem with that, though. I would have...
No, that would be interesting. You know, really, there's nothing here that would make me, like, throw my wine at the screen.
Yeah, I mean, all five films, if any of those won, I wouldn't, like, you know, go out and, like, start a riot or anything. I mean...
Yeah.
Well, good.
I'm gonna have to defer to the gods on this one. So,
well, and that was a big shocker when Crash won. I mean, I was shocked.
Not really. The momentum was behind that.
And again, with the prejudice thing, it was either going to be, you know, race or homosexuality. What's the issue? You know, and then they went with the issue they went with. And,
yeah.
I thought the
Brokeback had it. I mean, that's why I was personally shocked when Crash won. Just like I was shocked when Shakespeare won over Private Ryan. I mean,
right.
But there have been major shockers before in this Best Picture category, and you can't rely on the previous winners from the evening culminating into that Best Picture win.
No, you can't.
Yeah, well, except in, like, Lord of the Rings here, but, you know, that was...
Right. I'm going to say Juno. I think that it's going to be, not necessarily an upset, but I think Juno's going to take it.
You know why, also? Because Roger Ebert named it Best Picture of the Year. He named Crash Best Picture of the Year as well. And I think that his opinion has a lot of sway with Academy voters. I think Ebert just really has a lot of power, maybe more than he realizes. But you know, I think that I don't think that's anything to discount in a case like this.
I think that's probably right on target. But I think that there's such dark material this year.
Do you think they'll cancel each other?
I think they're going to go with Juno. I think they're going to go with a movie that is so widely beloved. I think that Little Miss Sunshine had this last year. But I found Little Miss Sunshine too, like, sitcom-y, so I didn't want it to win. I would like to see Juno take it home, actually, even though There Will Be Blood is a time capsule movie. And we've talked about this. Best Picture should be the movie that you put in a vault and you open 100 years from now. This is the best we did this year. I think that There Will Be Blood deserves it, but I think they're going to give it to Juno. Chris, what do you think?
I said the No Country for Old Men, in my opinion.
That's right.
I agree with your feelings about Juno and There Will Be Blood, but I just think that No Country has it in the bag.
Well, I'm happy with any of those choices.
That's it. This has been an exhaustive hour and a half dissection of the Oscars.
Gentlemen,
this would be great.
We still got a month to go.
I know. We're probably going to change our minds over the next month. But, Keith, we thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a great hour and a half of discussion, and you're welcome back, obviously, anytime you'd like.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Keith.
Okay, have a good night, guys.
Bye-bye now. Keith Ulick, a great roundtable talk about the Oscars this year. Okay, two-hour show gone.
Okay.
Hope everyone out there enjoyed it. Thanks for sticking around in the chat room and listening in. If you have any disagreements with us, you can always go to our Movie Geeks MySpace page and let us know, and we'll read some of your comments over the air in the next week or so on the show. I don't know when our next show is going to be. I don't think we're doing one on Wednesday. We might do one on Wednesday for home entertainment. But
we're not doing one for the Super Bowl.
Right. Next Sunday's the Super Bowl, so we're going to honor that. But look for the blog postings. We'll announce our next show. Guys, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And,
good night.
We'll see you all next time.